Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
We don't know everything we need to know yet about the Omicron variant.
Fighting a virus we don't yet fully understand. I speak with global public health experts Dr. Helen Reese and Ayoade Alakija about mixed messages and possible missteps. Then, in Oxford, Michigan, another mass shooting. I ask former gun industry executive Ryan Bussey, why is America the only country where this keeps happening? And
who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips?
Michelle Martin takes a fresh look at the legacy of Malcolm X with biographer Tamara Payne, author of The Dead Are Arising.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. I'm Bianca Golodriga. Christian Amanpour will be back tomorrow. Well, we are continuing to fight a virus that we do not fully understand yet, as we are learning more about the Omicron variant. Public health experts are doubling down on vaccines as the best protection against the mutation. Today, European Commissioner President Ursula von der Leyen broached the idea of mandatory vaccination for the European Union. But what do we actually know about the effectiveness of existing vaccines, and will they still be effective against future variants? We begin our exploration with a look at the South African scientist who first detected the variant from correspondent David McKenzie.
After tracking COVID for many months at this lab, Janine Duplessis is bracing herself.
Have you seen a lot more positive cases in the last few weeks?
Yes, we have.
First a trickle, then a flood. At the Wits Vida lab, they're studying a disturbing variant of an old foe.
Still too early to actually tell. There's so much that is so unknown about the variant. Everyone feels a little bit of hopelessness in a moment like that.
This lab is really at the coalface of the COVID response. You know, they're expanding so fast, they're putting their samples in freezers right here in the hallway. They come in shifts, and as this wave develops, they'll be operating 24 hours a day.
They know how bad it gets. This was Delta's awful impact in Johannesburg. In July, patients stacked in hallways, struggling to breathe, in exclusive footage obtained by CNN. At the Wits Vida lab and all across the globe, they're trying to understand whether Omicron is more transmissible, deadlier, whether it breaks through existing COVID-19 vaccines.
What does it feel like that the entire world is hanging on this discovery that was figured out here initially?
Yeah, so it does feel a bit sort of surreal when you watch the news and you see the impact it's having globally, and you're thinking, wow, you know, it's sort of affecting stock markets and and airlines and people's travel plans. You know, you kind of don't plan on having that sort of ripple effect.
A spike in cases first happened in Pretoria with a cluster infection at this technical university. But hints of a new variant were first detected by scientists and pathologists at Lancet Laboratories. In early November, they spotted a strange anomaly in their positive PCR tests. Then it happened over and over again. It reminded them of tests for the Alpha variant, first detected more than a year ago in the UK.
What was it like to see this anomaly cropping up again?
Well, it was a bit disturbing because we, you know, made us worry that we were dealing with something new. And because it coincided with an increase in positivity rates, it made us worry that we could be dealing with a new variant.
Lancet urgently notified South Africa's genomics team. Within days, they described and made public disturbing details of the highly mutated virus. Much of the world shut off travel from Southern Africa. And scientists here say they are now struggling to fly in critical reagent for their lab work to understand Omicron.
Why was it so important to alert everybody about this?
Especially with the reaction of the world to Southern Africa on the announcement of the variant. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, why don't you just keep quiet about what you find? But what's important is we know that a new variant is likely to cause an increase in cases, whether they be more severe or not.
Well, as the Omicron variant is now detected in more than 20 countries, we take a closer look at measures to preempt further spread with Dr. Helen Reese, medical researcher and chair of the WHO Immunization Advisory Group for Africa, and Ayoade Alakija, co-chair of the African Vaccine Delivery Alliance. She's speaking out forcefully against travel bans on Southern Africa. Welcome, both of you. Let me get with you, Dr. Reese, because today the vice chair of the South African Medical Association told CNN that so far, at least, the patients that they are seeing are younger, have milder cases, and those that are hospitalized are unvaccinated. Does that bear true to what you are seeing? And what does that indicate about the potency of this variant?
Well, I think it's a bit early to jump to sort of final conclusions, but obviously we're looking very hard at hospital admissions and who's being admitted and how sick they are, and also trying to work out have they been vaccinated or not, and have they been reinfected? Lots of questions to ask. Certainly, at the moment, it does appear that people are seeing younger people, you know, teens and under 12s, and even younger toddlers, but not severe disease in those categories yet, but it's far too early to conclude anything because these are very early days. Often severe disease will often present in people who are older and with comorbidities later after you start to see an increase in cases, not immediately.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Reese, but it seems that the two areas of most concern to experts are the mutations, the 30-plus mutations in the spike protein, obviously, that the vaccines do impact, correct? And the concern about transmissibility here. What, if anything, over the past, I believe we're close to a week now, of when the WHO made this an issue of global concern, what have you learned about those two issues?
Well, we certainly know that this is a very transmissible variant. Whether it's more transmissible than the Delta variant that we had before, we'll have to try and establish that. But it's certainly very transmissible because the numbers are going up very rapidly. We've also seen a trend towards people getting reinfected. People who had had an earlier infection with a different variant, we're now seeing a number of people getting reinfected as well. But of real concern, and this is what the world is really focusing on, is that with the number of mutations on the spike protein, what will this mean for protection that we are all hoping will come from vaccines? So there are more mutations in this variant than we've seen in any previous variant. And the spike protein is the part of the virus that all of the vaccines we currently have, well, most of the vaccines we currently have, are designed to target. And if that has changed considerably, the concern is, will the vaccines still work? Will they work just less well? Will they work less well for mild disease? Will they still work well for severe disease? And at the moment, the hope is that we will retain a level of function with the current vaccines against severe disease, but there might well be an impact on their protection against mild disease.
And Ayade, it is for this very reason that we don't know the effectiveness of vaccines against this new Omicron variant that we have seen countries, including the United States, put a temporary ban on travel in Southern African countries. You have objected to this travel ban, and President Biden has spoken out about it, saying that we just need more time to learn more. Why do you object to this, and what message does that send to those countries?
Hi, Bianna. Thank you. And it's also lovely to be on here with Helen. Hello, Helen. I think it's not that I object to travel bans as a general principle. What I have said is that if we're going to ban or if we're going to have travel restrictions, let us have a coordinated global approach. Let us not single out the part of the world that has actually alerted us to this problem. Let us not single out Southern Africa. And actually today we're seeing now Nigeria, which is where I'm sitting in Abuja, is also now being banned by various countries. So what we have is virus now on about 30 plus. I mean, it's changing so quickly, you know, the one is keeping up by the minute. So about 30 something countries across the planet, almost on every single continent. And yet the only travel black bans we have in place are for African countries. So that is the issue that I have, is that this is discriminatory, because Africa and Southern Africa in particular, and Helen and a lot of her colleagues have done an incredible job in sequencing and in identifying this variant. Why are we putting in punitive measures to those who've actually done the best job? Why are we singling out Africa? So if we're going to have bans, let us have a global coordinated travel shutdown for a month if it is necessary, but do not single out one particular part of the world.
And Dr. Alakija, given what you've just described, what are the implications of this shutdown for not only political reasons from these countries? I mean, we have heard concerns about, you know, we've come forward, the South African leaders saying we have come forward because we are so advanced in genome sequencing, and thus we've alerted the world, and we're being punished with these travel bans. What are the longer term implications, both politically and scientifically, in your view?
Well, I mean, let me start with the science. I mean, first of all, these bans are not based in science. Yes, we're saying we want to slow down the seeding, some of the governments have said, but we don't know where this started. We don't know when it started. What has found it out? What it's clearly shown is that Southern Africa and South Africa are far more advanced in their pandemic preparedness than most of the high-income countries of the world, because we've now learned that it was already in the Netherlands 11 or so, to about almost 2 weeks before it was identified in Southern Africa. So from a scientific perspective, what this is going to do, it's going to shut scientists down. People are not going to come forward and say, well, we have identified this, there is a variant, this is what we're worried about, because they'll be worried about what the other point you made about the trade implications, the economy, the economic implications of their on their countries. I mean, already we're seeing markets tank. We're seeing stock prices fall, except for the, you know, big pharma companies, of course, that are making an absolute fortune out of all of this. But, you know, we're seeing markets begin to react in a very negative way. So Africa is just beginning to try to creep out into its recovery phase, some of our countries, and now that is all over. You know, we are, I mean, that's from the macro level. We're seeing inflation rise. We're seeing economic downturn already. You know, on the micro level, we're going into the holidays. I mean, I will give you a personal example. I'm in Abuja today in a complete panic because my daughter is not in this country. She was due to be arriving tomorrow morning. There are families, millions of families like that, all over the continent who are either traveling out or coming in. There's a social implication of this. There's an economic implication. But most of all, we're dealing with something that has become so geopolitical that we need to solve it with political leadership, not just with sort of knee-jerk reactions from high-income countries and no response from our leaders, or very limited response from our leaders in the global south.
Dr. Rees, Dr. Alakija just touched on the pharmaceutical companies and these vaccine makers. And I was really puzzled by two very different interviews given by the head of BioNTech, who, again, both preface their interviews by saying we need more data. But the head of BioNTech said that he believes that the current vaccine in its form will be able to work rather successfully against the Omicron variant. And you counter that with an interview that the Moderna CEO gave to the Financial Times, where he, in a sense, sort of projected the opposite and suggested that from the scientists he's spoken with, that there will inevitably be a need for either a tweak or a different vaccine to tackle this. And if I'm confused, I'm not a scientist, but I'm a journalist and I follow this, I would imagine, more thoroughly than just the average citizen who's trying to get by in life. How do you interpret this and how should the public interpret it?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is an evolution of understanding, and it's because we don't yet know. And so you are going to get a lot of different opinions on what might happen. What we do know is that with previous variants, that we've seen a reduction in the effectiveness of vaccines in being able to act against those variants. Not a complete wipeout, but a reduction. And it will be a different level of reduction according to which vaccine that you look at. So when we look at the Omicron variant, we know, as I said, that the spike protein has changed significantly. So we don't now know whether existing vaccines that were not designed for this variant, they were designed for the original ancestral virus, will they still work? What we're hoping is that we'll see what we've seen with the earlier variants, that they might well be less effective against mild disease because that's to do with antibodies. And we have seen with other vaccines and variants that the antibody effect is reduced. The effectiveness of the antibodies produced by the vaccine is diminished. And that seems to increase the risk of mild to moderate disease. But they have all tended to keep their ability to be active in protecting against severe disease and hospitalization. And that's because it's a different part of the immune system, we think, that gives that protection. So the bottom line is, why you're getting different opinions is that we still don't know. But in the meantime, what we're doing is two things. First of all, there's a plethora of research going on in many countries, South Africa included, but in many countries around the world, to try and answer those questions, both with lab studies, with animal studies, and we will be looking at effectiveness studies in the clinical setting, in the real world setting. So we're trying to answer, will these vaccines still work or not? But from the manufacturer's point of view, they're already saying, now, if they don't work, and they really don't work as well, can we change our vaccine so that it's once again effective against the Omicron variant? And they are actively looking at doing that. That's not a quick process, but thank goodness, because of the speed with which we're now able to develop vaccines, that is a much more rapid process. But nonetheless, it would take weeks to design that vaccine and probably, certainly months to get it into production and out.
And that raises sort of a conundrum as to whether these manufacturers focus on the new Omicron variant or continue the manufacturing of the vaccines as they are in combating the Delta variant. When do you think, Dr. Reese, that we will know whether the Omicron variant, which you and others believe to be highly transmissible, could actually cancel out the Delta variant? And that obviously would give these manufacturers more of a view as to which direction they should go.
Well, the laboratory studies, as I say, are already underway around the world, and those take weeks. Not months, but weeks. So we'll get an impression from those laboratory studies about what's going to happen. But what we're also doing, and remember that South Africa's numbers are going up quite steeply, which is this high transmissibility and the high numbers sort of effect that we're seeing. We will be able to look at hospitalization and whether people have been vaccinated and the severity of disease. So we will be able to get some of those answers. We're looking at those. Possibly we'll get some initial answers perhaps in weeks and certainly over the next couple of months as we see how this turns out. So that will tell us. But in the meantime, we will do what we did at the beginning of the pandemic, and we'll say to manufacturers, plan for the worst. Don't wait to see. We don't need to wait to see this. We will continue to use the current vaccines because we're all optimistic that there will be a level of protection, particularly against severe disease. But to the manufacturers, please go ahead and design sort of plan B in case we do find that this is significantly reduced.
And Dr. Alakija, this sort of puts us into the tale of two realities that the hemispheres are feeling right now, because in the United States and in much of the Western countries, we're having leaders talk about perhaps mandates for vaccines and getting boosters. And meantime, only 5% of people living in lower income countries have received even one dose of a vaccine. This continues to be a problem. We continue to discuss it. But you would think that given this new variant, it becomes front and center once again.
Well, there's a terrifying sense of deja vu, isn't there? It feels like we have rolled back to March 2020, and we really must learn the lessons of the past. I think what Helen has been saying is very pertinent, but she has repeatedly said, we don't know, we are researching. And that is the question here. What do we have ahead of us? We don't know. We don't know whether the vaccine, that this variant is going to be vaccine evasive. But as you've already heard, the current vaccines, let's at least roll those out. Let's get those to as many people as we can, as quickly as we can. This is not an Africa problem. It's not a Southern Africa problem. It's a global problem. And so we must urgently vaccinate the world. The concern now is with the mandate, not just the mandates. Even in Africa, in Nigeria, we had a mandate put out today that says that unless you're vaccinated, you can't go into certain government buildings and airports and facilities, which is really quite bizarre because we just don't have the vaccines. We don't have the supply, and therefore, of maybe 200 million people, only about 12 million have so far been vaccinated. So that's going to limit a lot of people's economic activity. But we have to ensure that we do get the vaccines that are currently thought to be effective, at least to some extent, that we do get them into the arms of people as quickly as possible all over the world. Because I think the upshoot of this, and what we haven't discussed yet, is that this variant has arisen because viruses do that. They sort of replicate and then they mutate if they're allowed to jump from host to host. Mm-hmm. And if we could continue to have huge populations, millions and millions of people, billions around the world, who do not have access to vaccines and who therefore are not able to protect themselves and their communities, we run the risk of even more variants. We run the risk of going from, as I've said before, from Omicron to Omega. And who knows whether we're going to be able to control or harness the Omega variant. This is becoming, for some countries, an existential issue. And vaccine and diagnostics and therapeutics, the issue of equity and justice is front and center in all of this. And so for me, that has been my mantra over the last year. It has been an exhausting year of just trying to get the high-income countries to understand that it is in their enlightened self-interest.
It's in everyone's interest. It's in the world's interest. And, you know, we haven't even touched on vaccine hesitancy. And unfortunately, we don't have time today to continue this conversation. But we will come back to both of you as we continue to learn more about this new variant. Thank you so much, Dr. Reese, Dr. Alakija. We appreciate it. Well, turning to the United States now, where another high school shooting leaves four American teenagers dead. After a 15-year-old student went on a five-minute shooting spree at Michigan's Oxford High School. There are already 25 mass shootings in America this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, who represents Sandy Hook, site of another school killing rampage, spoke out yesterday on what Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer calls a uniquely American problem.
This only happens in the United States of America. There's no other nation in the high-income world in which kids worry about being shot when they go to school. It happens here in America because we choose to let it happen. We're not unlucky. This is purposeful. This is a choice made by the United States Senate to sit on our hands and do nothing while kids die.
As a former executive of one of America's top gun manufacturers, Ryan Bussey saw his industry evolve from serving hobbyists and hunters to putting a stranglehold on U.S. politics. Now he's speaking out against what he calls the industry that radicalized America in his new book, Gunfight. Ryan Bussey, welcome to the program. This, out of all subjects, unfortunately, is very timely to have booked you on. It could have been an evergreen booking. You just published this book, but this happens the day after yet another mass shooting at a U.S. school. I'd like to get two perspectives from you because you have a unique angle to this subject. One, your reaction as the author of this book to this latest shooting.
Well, thanks for having me, Bianna. I think Senator Murphy is right. We have decided as a country that we have to buy into the politics of the NRA, this all or nothing. We must have everything, all freedoms and no responsibility. And I know that there are millions of responsible gun owners who are just frankly fed up with this. I'm one of them. I arrived here in New York yesterday, and upon arriving, our son texted us that there was an event like this that was thwarted in his own high school back in Montana. And it's not okay that we allow this to happen. I think Senator Murphy is right. We don't have to have this all or nothing 100% loyalty choice that the NRA has forced upon our country.
So let me ask you now the very same question and what your response would have been in your many years working in the gun industry.
Well, I think that I am a gun owner. I'm a proud gun owner. I shoot and hunt with my boys, and I want to continue to do that. But that does not mean that we can't opt for decency and responsibility and policies that mitigate the sort of things that we saw yesterday. A democracy is not going to exist with 100% or 0%. It's going to exist somewhere in the gray area, and frankly, we're far out of whack right now. And so my response would have been, as it was, that we should say yes to responsible gun regulations. It doesn't mean we're taking everybody's guns. We're not taking my guns. But to do and institute and accept policies that are responsible and that mitigate these sort of outcomes, that's what we must do as Americans. That's what we do in every other place in our lives and our policies.
So then, were you an outlier among your colleagues, either at Kimber or within the, you know, your colleagues in the National Rifle Association? Because publicly, that's not the response that we hear from them, either the gun manufacturers or the gun lobby following a school shooting.
Yeah, I you know, the book is about me and my transition from growing up on a farm and ranch and being in the middle of what I thought was a dream job and a dream career. And frankly, early on in the industry, it was an industry that understood these sort of responsible behaviors and responsible policies. Eventually, I did become an outlier because I'm not okay with saying no to responsibility. I'm not. If we have a Statue of Liberty on one coast, we should have a Statue of Responsibility on the other coast. Something as critical and important and powerful as firearms ownership and the Second Amendment cannot exist in our country if it's not balanced with the proper responsibility. And so, yes, I did become an outlier, and the book is about my battle, my personal battle, my family's battle, and then my battle as I left the industry to try to do the right thing, and I'm trying to do the right thing now.
You write in the book that you were born with a, quote, shotgun in one hand and a rifle in the other. You grew up hunting with your father. You and your boys hunt as well. Talk about the cultural change, though, for the industry as a whole, from when you started working to what made you finally decide in 2020 that you'd had enough.
I came to find through my time in the industry and through my advocacy for things that I really love, particularly conservation, environmental policy, that those things were just fodder for a political power and monetary machine of the NRA. And as the industry and the NRA became inextricably intertwined, I realized that this was really no longer about guns or patriotism or bravery or all the sorts of things that are intertwined in some dangerous portions of gun sales now. It was about political power, and it was about money. And that distressed me greatly. And so over time, I saw a focus on what I believe are wholesome parts of gun ownership in America. Self-defense, I believe in that, although that's become a very sticky wicket with so many people having guns. Kyle Rittenhouse, open armed intimidation. It's very dangerous now. But I believe in self-defense. I believe in target shooting and hunting and all those sort of cultural connections to shooting that are so important to so many Americans. But there are millions of us that are just not down with armed intimidation, with Kyle Rittenhouse, with vigilantes, with people attacking and killing Ahmaud Arbery with a gun. Like, this is craziness, and it has to stop.
You describe that the Columbine shooting was really a turning point for the industry. And since then, every mass shooting, whether at a school or at a public venue, would result in a spike in gun sales. And that perhaps after Columbine, that spike in sales surprised your colleagues and those within the industry. But then they quickly caught on to what was happening. And this became a real political issue. Explain how.
So the book details, you know, my linkage with the industry as it realized that mass shootings and political turmoil could both drive voters to the polls. The NRA figured this out. But then it also, the same thing that drove voters to the polls, fear, conspiracy theory, hatred of the other, that also drove gun sales. And so those things became linked, and over time they became linked so tightly that they could not become unlinked anymore. And that's why it's not an accident that in the most tumultuous period in our lifetimes, the most political, societal tumult that we've experienced the last 18 months in our lifetimes, is also the highest period of gun sales ever in the history of the country by a huge factor, even more so than the worst shootings, the most horrific shootings that we've ever seen, the Sandy Hook shootings. The sales spiked hugely then. So if you overlay gun sales with mass shootings and Democratic election wins, they match perfectly. And it's just an unholy alliance that relies upon that.
And you talk about a moment, perhaps it's after the Columbine shooting, the late 90s, when there was an opportunity following what lawmakers saw happen with the tobacco industry and the settlements there and some of the reforms made to go after gun makers. And Smith & Wesson was an organization, was a company that decided to comply and shocked everyone in your industry and worked with the Clinton administration. They quickly, though, became outliers and ostracized within the industry, and the industry decided that their new policy was not giving an inch. What would have happened had others followed suit in Smith & Wesson's and what they did, as opposed to where they are right now? And talk about the role that you yourself played in that.
So I don't know where we would have ended up if more companies would have followed that lead. And I'm not sure, and I don't espouse that was necessarily a perfect lead. I do know that that's the point at which American politics changed, changed into what this divisive chasm is that we have today, because the NRA decided, and sadly, I played a role in it. I was a willing soldier then. I had a political transformation and a personal epiphany not many years after that this sort of persecute, what happened then was that the NRA and the rest of the industry, aided largely by me, persecuted Ed Schultz, who was the CEO of Smith & Wesson, and basically drove Smith & Wesson out of business. They were sold for not many months after that for $15 million. And a few years later, in 2016, their market cap was $1.69 billion. So you can see the sort of monetary damage that was done. Ed Schultz was fired. And if that sounds a lot like our all-or-nothing politics today, where you have to be 100% for some candidate or 0%, there is no in the middle. Just ask Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger. It is exactly like that. That's where our modern politics was developed. It was perfected by the NRA, and then it was handed off to the American right.
We're seeing the NRA constantly in the headlines the past few years, losing some of their status, their wealth, having filed for bankruptcy. But in an interview I listened to, you warned that we shouldn't read too much into that and into the future of the lobby as a whole.
I think that we should not put too much stock in that. The NRA may be weakened at current, but the politics and the brush fire that the NRA has let across this country is not weakened. It's metaphorically dry, the wind is blowing, and this political division, just ask families who just endured Thanksgiving. I'm sure there are families who couldn't talk to each other because of this divisive politics, this all or nothing thing. That's all linked to the politics of the NRA. It started back in my early time in the industry. It's all detailed in the book, but this sort of divisive ugliness where workplaces and families and friendships are torn apart over these all-or-nothing politics, it has its roots in the gun politics of the NRA.
You begin the book by talking about your own son and family being accosted when you attended a Black Lives Matter rally in your hometown. How did that impact you, and why did that lead you to come to the conclusion that you needed to write this book?
That was a frightening day. It was frightening and very heartening at the same time. I live in northwestern Montana, and it's known to be home of some very dangerous white supremacist groups. Yet, in the town where we live, there were more than almost 2,000 people who had gathered, largely young people, high school kids, to rally for Black Lives that day. And my family and I thought it was important, and we went down, and we did the same. And my young son, Badge, who was 12 at the time and maybe 75 pounds soaking wet, was attacked by one of these Second Amendment patriots, these armed guys, who was angry, and he just started screaming at him and poking his finger in his chest. And it was terrifying. I looked at that much like a marketing, executive for a food company must feel like when they walk in a grocery store and see the product they helped develop up on the shelf. I thought, my God, here it is, this product that the gun industry has made, this angry armed man who's attacking my son. I had already decided to get out, but that only furthered my resolve to get out and write this book. I think it's very dangerous. I'm worried about where the country is headed.
What do you tell people around the world, and what would you like Americans to see in terms of the fear you have of where this country is headed in the years to come?
Well, I think the gun issue is very emblematic of our politics. We can have democracy, we can have representative government, but we cannot have runaway rights with no responsibility. And I believe, as I present in the book, that we will begin to see improvement in our national politics when we figure out how to address the gun issue, because America is beautiful. It is unique. But it requires responsibility from our citizenry. And for some reason, we have forgot that and glossed over it. And I think it's time for responsible gun owners to stand up and be a part of the solution.
And this as the Supreme Court is going to be hearing an open carry case this year. So it's a timely book, no doubt. Unfortunate timeliness that this interview transpired 24 hours after another mass shooting in the United States, but that this is the reality that we live with. And unfortunately, we have to stop being so numb to it and make some of the changes that you say are necessary. Thank you so much for the time.
We
appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Well, next, we examine the powerful but polarizing legacy of civil rights icon Malcolm X following the recent exoneration of two of his convicted assassins. This year's Pulitzer Prize for Biography delves into a never-before-seen world of its protagonists. The Dead Are Arising was 30 years in the making and co-authored by Tamara Payne and her late father, Les. She finished the work after his passing. Here is Tamara speaking with Michelle Martin about Malcolm X's life and death.
Thanks, Bianna. Tamara Payne, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
As we are speaking now, there has been incredible news in the story that you and your father spent years researching and writing about. I mean, as we are speaking now, two of the men who were convicted and spent decades in prison for the murder of Malcolm X were finally exonerated. Muhammad Aziz, who's 83, and Khalil Islam, who died in 2009, they spent decades in prison for the murder of Malcolm X. Why did it take so long to clear their names? Do you know?
Well, I think that is the question that needs to be answered. We interviewed both of them. We interviewed Khalil Islam as well as Muhammad Abdulaziz, and both of them told us they were not there inside the ballroom. And as we laid out in the book, the assassination team does come from Newark, in the Newark Mosque. But the thing is, what's shocking, because I did read the joint motion that was filed last week, and what's shocking is there was a report in there that was dated February 22nd, 1965, the day after Malcolm was killed. And they state in this report that possibly the killers were transported into New York. This is an FBI file. So they had this information. And they also said that we're able to name in that file the day after Malcolm was killed that the shooters were sitting in the front row. And so we didn't have these unredacted reports. We did our own investigation and asking people what they saw, what they experienced. But reading that, it was really chilling to find out that as early as February 22nd, 1965, that they actually had a description of, for example, of the man on the shotgun.
You know, subsequently, he confessed to killing Malcolm X, but he also subsequently made clear that the other two men who were convicted along with him were not involved. So why all these years did they just languish in prison, sort of all these years?
Halim, who was caught on the scene by the crowd and was beaten up by the crowd outside of the Audubon, he actually at first testified that he had nothing to do with the Nation of Islam, but then he changed it because he realized that these two men that were on trial with him, they had nothing to do with the assassination. So he, wanted to clear their name. And even after the trial, he spent over two decades just helping with, giving out the descriptions of the other killers, giving out the names even, and how it came together in an affidavit. And so this is information that he provided. He changed his mind in the middle of the trial and he worked diligently to try to clear this. Again, the question goes back to the authorities.
So let's go back a bit then. Malcolm was born in Omaha, Nebraska, later moved to Lansing, Michigan. Your book opens with this just really horrifying scene where his mother, who's pregnant with one of her eight children, her husband, who's an itinerant preacher, who's a sort of a circuit riding preacher, is away at the time. And the Klan comes to their house and threatens them. And she, as it's described in the book, stands her ground, even though you can imagine how terrifying this would have been. This woman alone in the house with little children And they're trying to, what, intimidate her because her husband was outspoken. They were followers of Marcus Garvey and so forth. And so this is how the book opens. So this gives you kind of a context for how he grew up. I mean, he was a petty criminal. I mean, this is not a secret. Everybody knows this is about him. And that at some point he discovers the Nation of Islam. Could you just talk a little bit more about what position he held and why he was such an important figure?
You know, the purpose of this book really is to look at Malcolm because of the interviews that we were able to get and obtain and have with not only Malcolm's siblings, but people who knew Malcolm, who went to school with Malcolm, who spoke with his classmates, who spoke to people who were in jail with him and at different every phase of his life. And what we were learning is that there's this side of Malcolm that we don't know. And that goes beyond the speeches, that go beyond the autobiography, that up until our book, people weren't really, you know, talking about that. Who is Malcolm, right? And what was he like? Was he funny? You know, what kind of student was he? Was he precocious? But the other thing is, we wanted to talk about the world Malcolm was born into because this shapes him too, right? I mean, he's not joining the Nation of Islam, talking about blue-eyed devils, you know, because it's fun. He's doing this because this country is against Black people succeeding. You know, and so the Nation of Islam provides an organization in which they can organize other Black people in the towns that they lived in and build up their community.
I think it's important to because I think people may have read the autobiography of Malcolm X. They may have seen Spike Lee's movie, you know, X. But you're providing sort of the bigger picture of like, what is the world that made him as opposed to just and he, you know, he didn't just arrive, you know, fully formed as this amazing orator. How did he rise so quickly within the Nation of Islam?
Because it was an organization that was really about dealing with Black people and how they move in society. And they spoke to the issues and the problems of Black people very directly, you know, and that's where Malcolm really shines, where they already have the language, you know, that they use to describe, you know, white supremacy and their white oppressors. And Malcolm just carries that forth.
Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet?
There's a chapter in this book in Hartford where Malcolm's organizing this temple. And he's directly like, you see him as a leader, like with these people, listening to their stories and then organizing them to, you know, understand the tenets of the Nation of Islam, you know, getting rid of the vices, you know, smoking, mm-hmm. eating pork, all of that, alcohol, drinking, all of that, gambling. And one of the things that a lot of the men were saying, and the women actually, was that they said that they felt happy to be Black for the first time because he was giving them something to do, wasn't just responding, but to being, you know, proactive in who you are as a Black people and building your community, building your businesses. Mm-hmm. So Martin Luther King is and the civil rights movement, they're dealing with the superstructure of white supremacy, changing the laws, you know, mm-hmm. voting rights and the civil rights bill. What Malcolm, the Nation of Islam, is really focusing is the mind of Black people and responding to this white supremacist structure.
There are a lot of revelations in your book. I mean, it coming out so long ago and detailing the last days of his life as he did. But one of the eye-popping revelations is the meeting that they had with the Klan. that just wasn't on my radar at all. So tell me about that as briefly as you can, because it's just like, wait, what?
Yeah. Well, the meeting with the Klan came about when Malcolm was visiting the Nation of Islam Mosque in Georgia, which was in Atlanta. And the minister there was Jeremiah Shabazz, well, then known as Jeremiah X. And Malcolm was speaking there. And while speaking there, they received a telegram from the local chapter of the Klan. And they said that they were interested in having a meeting with the Nation of Islam. They felt that there were similarities that they had. You know, the Klan was against integration. Martin Luther King was kicking their butt about on that, changing the minds of a lot of people. And they didn't like that. But they understood the Nation of Islam. They wanted separation. you know? And so they said, well, maybe there's something we can do that we can work together on. And Malcolm, you know, understanding, getting this telegram, understanding, you know, what this can be, his view is that, you know, he wants to have a face-off. He wants to fight with them, because Malcolm has this, he has good reason to not want anything to do with it. He believed that the Klan murdered his father. He understood the Klan had, you know, visited their doorstep when he was in utero. I mean, you know, he doesn't, and he feels that any alliance also with the Klan is an unholy alliance. But
I mean, it is a terrorist organization, so it's not like his concerns were unfounded. I mean, it's a terrorist organization that,
well, yeah, and also, but he's not the leader of the organization, neither is Jeremiah. So they have to go back to Elijah Muhammad. So Elijah Muhammad says, hey, I have this Southern plan that I want to put out. I want to build more businesses. I want to have farms. I want to buy more land in the South. And the Klan's everywhere. They're the bankers, they're the real estate brokers, they're the police. And we can't, we're going to have to figure something out. So let's meet with them, see what we can do and if they can help us. And, you know, let's hear them out. You know, Malcolm doesn't want to do that, but he doesn't want the nation to come out of this with the short end of the stick. So he wants to be a part of the meeting, at least for that.
Did anything come of it?
Well, I mean, what Malcolm came out of this was with a bad taste in his mouth about having a meeting with the Klan. And what he realized is that, you know, Elijah Muhammad was willing to have a meeting with them, listen to them. And this is kind of where we start to see him separate from Elijah mm-hmm. Muhammad philosophically.
Well, you've alluded to that. I think many people who don't know the story will, you know, wonder, you know, why did somebody from the Newark Mosque want him killed? Why is it that people from within the organization wanted him killed?
When Malcolm first even joined the organization, people are very jealous of him because he was very smart. He could speak to people who are educated as well as people who are in the streets. Mm-hmm. He can speak to both. And he wanted to bring more people who are educated because he thought that they would have more ideas and direction and organizing, you know, that would be even more effective. And that's kind of where he wanted to do. People who are already members of the Nation of Islam, they didn't have that kind of background. They felt that this changed and it bothered them. So there were these jealousies that started even when he mm-hmm. came in, and it grew. These people also try to turn, you know, Elijah Muhammad against Malcolm, saying, oh, look at the way he's going to try and take over the organization from Elijah Muhammad. Look at the way he's organizing. And Elijah Muhammad, he's growing my numbers, my membership numbers incredibly. This is what I want, you know? But what happens is that these jealousies continue. But then also Malcolm starts to see outgrow the organization anyway, because, again, the differences that we talk about, for example, after the Klan meeting. And this grows. But understand, the seed has already been planted even when he started.
And then there was, and this is not a secret, that he had learned that Elijah Muhammad had impregnated some of his young secretaries and then kicked them out of the organization for being immoral. And when he confronted him about this, he was like, how does this square with the kind of conservative social values that you've been inculcating in us? And he sort of portrayed himself as a biblical figure. So that certainly had to have been disturbing. And then wasn't it Malcolm's own views around sort of the segregation versus integration, right? After his own visit to Mecca, like his own worldview about whether segregation was really the right course for Black people, which is that?
As time is playing on it, and keep in mind that we have people fighting for the Civil Rights Bill and people are being hunted down the streets by, you know, national security guards and all that in the Civil Rights Movement. And Malcolm's seeing this, and he also feels that it's coming to a time, he starts to feel that we all need to pitch into this fight, you know? He's outgrowing the nation. You know, this difference of opinion. Yes, the babies that, you know, Elijah Muhammad fathered, yes, this was a problem, but it was not the only or even the major issue, but it was an issue. Because once Malcolm starts speaking about that, he's breaking a lot of the rules, right? And now he's become, you know, he's going, I guess, you know, he's going after the leader right now. At that point. So he becomes a huge threat, you know, but Malcolm has to split. He understands that he can't really be by himself to do the work that he wants to do, which is, you know, to continue this fight for the lives of Black people. He needs an organization. But he needs an organization that's going to grow with his philosophy, right? So yeah. That's what he developed. He comes with the idea of having these two organizations. He takes his Hajj after he splits from the Nation of Islam. But towards the end of that, his tenure in the Nation, he has met with and befriended people who are Sunni. And so he's studying with them and he's reading their literature because he wants to, you know, really kind of further understand what, you know, this religion is, the Islamic religion is, as opposed to what they're teaching in the Nation of Islam. It was not, you know, Orthodox Islam. So he's going in that direction in the religious sense, but also in the mind sense, he's outgrown the Nation altogether. He is seen as a traitor. He's not following the rules.
What effect do you think his death had on sort of social justice movements, not just in the United States, but worldwide? I mean, important to remember, in 1965, this kind of ushered in a season of violence. I mean, Martin Luther King was killed later on, and Robert F. Kennedy was killed, you know, subsequently. And it just seems like this sort of inaugurated this, it seems in hindsight that this kind of inaugurated the season of attack on these kinds of leaders. How do you see that?
I think that we have to also look at what's happening in the world. You know, in 1963, 64, which you're also seeing are countries, African countries, you know, who are over, you know, getting away from their colonizers, right? Like Ghana, like Nigeria, like Kenya. And he's meeting with these leaders, the leaders who are taking over these countries. But his philosophy has always been about connecting up with Africa. Keep in mind, his mother was raised by Nigerians and she talked about Africa all the time. So he was very much aware that we are Africans, we are of African descent, and there's a whole continent. And then when he's studying, he's like, all these minerals come out of Africa and we should have a relationship to this.
But what effect do you think his death had on these movements?
It was an immediate cut into building up that the relationship between African Americans and Africans on the continent. I mean, now, does that mean that we don't have relationships? No. I mean, people still travel. We still had relationships. But he was really connecting it in a way that could have cut out a lot of the stuff that we have experienced since then.
Why do you think he remains such a towering cultural figure?
I think it's really hard to get around now. It just is. I mean, people tried, but he keeps coming up. He's coming up in our music. Imagine what Malcolm would have been like if he had the internet, right? But he had the television when the television came out, and he mastered that, and he used that to his ability like nobody else. And you can't really get around that because you look at those speeches now. You can listen to them, but to watch him speak is amazing. Even today. And it's so important to see that he knew how to use that to his advantage. The other thing, and let's not forget, the newspaper that still exists in the Nation of Islam, he started that. He started the newspaper because he believed that they had to have a control of their communication and the information they put out to their community and not rely on the media, because the media in a way was distorting how, you know, who they were.
Mary Payne, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So interesting to learn more about Malcolm X's thinking and his legacy. And finally, one step closer to saving the white rhino. After 30 were transferred from South Africa to Rwanda as part of a conservation program. Zane Asher has more.
40 hours and some 3,400 kilometers. 30 white rhinos complete a long journey from South Africa to a new home in Rwanda. It's the largest single transfer of the species and a move to replenish the white rhino's struggling population, one largely devastated by poaching since the 1970s. The journey was no easy feat. White rhinos are one of the largest land mammal species and can weigh up to 2 tons. Following months of preparation, the partially sedated rhinos were transferred from South Africa's Pinda Private Game Reserve. They boarded a Boeing 747 to Rwanda, to their final destination. Akagera National Park, a space that the staff of African Parks believes will provide a safe haven for the threatened species.
We brought black rhinos here in 2017. They are thriving. We brought The lions here, they're thriving. We've proven as the management of the park, but also with the government collaboration, that it's a safe, progressive place and that we can ensure their security.
Poaching remains the primary threat to these animals, targeted for their horns. There are only about 20,000 southern white rhinos remaining, considered near threatened. And only two females of another subspecies, the northern white rhino, on the brink of extinction. The 30 white rhinos are welcome additions to the park, which has seen a decline in tourism during the COVID-19 pandemic. White rhinos enjoy grazing in open spaces, so visiting tourists can expect to get a good look.
The white rhinos are going to be seen in the open spaces by almost all the tourists. So it's going to be something that will really help a lot on the tourism side.
Initially placed in two large enclosures, authorities say the rhinos will soon be able to roam the expansive park with plenty of room to grow.
And that's it for our program tonight. Remember, you can follow me and the show on Twitter. Join us again tomorrow night.